It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Judge Brett Kavanaugh became Justice Brett Kavanaugh Saturday as he was sworn in as the 114th Justice to the United States Supreme Court. Kavanaugh's selection cements conservative control of the High Court, possibly for decades. What's your reaction to the Senate's vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Charlie Jacobs joins us to talk about this today. He's an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. His areas of expertise include American politics and judicial process. Charlie, thanks for joining us this morning on The Morning Show.
My pleasure, John.
So it's been one heck of a political weekend. What's different now from 48 hours ago?
What's different now is that Justice Kavanaugh will arrive at his chambers. He'll start working on the business of the court, which really kicked off about a week ago when the session began, although, of course, the court and its staff has been working for a long time. In the near term, we're not going to see any significant change in what is occurring on the court. They'll do their business as usual. What we have to wait for is the announcement of some opinions, and some opinions that will give us some sort of signal about how he is behaving, whether or not he is voting in a consistent fashion, either in a liberal direction or in a conservative direction, and with whom he's voting. So the blocks of justices that he is working with to come up with particular decisions. So there's going to be a lag here. We're not really going to know much, and really the blockbuster cases in any term of the United States Supreme Court, they don't come until June anyway, because they typically sit on them while they work on the language and the interpretation of the law. So for most of us who study the court, it's a wait and see until we get some data to work with to see exactly what's going on.
As a practical matter, I mean, what's the real timeline for Justice Kavanaugh? Yes, he's sworn in. Yes, he's a member of the court. Yes, he'll be in his office. There'll be some ramping up. What's the process for getting him situated there?
So the process is he has four clerks with whom he'll work this year. Typically, the justices pick their own clerks, but in this kind of situation, he is probably going to have the opportunity to work with some individuals who are already on staff. What the clerks do is a lot of the scut work, the sort of checking and the analyzing prior to things getting to Justice Kavanaugh's desk. So they are the right-hand women and men for the justice, and they're typically graduates of the very best law schools in the United States. And so what they have been doing over the last several weeks and months is looking at cases that are coming to the court, reading the briefs from the attorneys, and creating for the justice some ideas about what's important about the case. So there are cases being argued this week. My guess is although the court, I don't think, has announced this, is he will sit on every single one of them, and he will be prepared to go because of the work his clerks have done for him. So he's getting thrown into the deep end of the pool Monday morning. There's no avoiding the work for him. The only thing he will likely not be part of are the cases that were argued last week, and there's six of them. Now, there's nothing in law or really the formal rules of the court that prohibit him from even participating after the fact, but that is highly unlikely because that goes beyond the norms of the court. So this week, you will see him as a full-fledged member of the court. There's no initiation process. He's been sitting on the D.C. Circuit Court for years. He knows the process of being on a collegial court like this, so he won't have any trouble adapting to the situation. He'll just jump right in and start doing the work with his eight other justices.
800-642-1234. What do you make of this situation with all that's gone on for the last month with this nomination? Let us know, 800-642-1234. Well, to say that the last 2 weeks have been pretty emotional for everyone involved would be understating it, I think, by quite a bit. And people around the country watching the proceedings. Charlie, have you ever seen anything like this in a Supreme Court nomination battle?
I mean, the closest is obviously the Thomas nomination in 1991. That was a little bit different, I think, because it was very much an 11th hour kind of issue. I think that with Justice Kavanaugh, there were more significant criticisms of his record that I think embroiled most of the public in a discussion about whether or not he should serve on the court. With Thomas, I think because of certain conditions there, including stepping down of Thurgood Marshall and replacing him with the second African-American on the court, there was sort of less of an argument about his background and his ability to serve on the court than we see today. Certainly, I think what Kavanaugh was facing was this backlash about privilege and whether or not he was qualified both on his ideology, but also maybe on issues of empathy and whether or not he was going to be able to serve in a particular way on the bench. So I think Thomas is close, and certainly Thurgood Marshall himself, that was a very contentious nomination. In fact, he probably faced more questions as a nominee than most of the nominees prior to him. And it was because he was being pushed by Southern Democrats in particular about whether or not he should be on the court, and that had to do primarily with race. So those are the ones I think that sort of come to mind. I mean, there's always going to be a political debate about these individuals, especially in the modern era. We tend not to get as angry and as chaotic as we've seen in this one. And I think Kavanaugh is going to have to sort of take a deep breath about how he's going to approach being a justice, at least in his first year, until some of this is tamped down and we kind of forget all of the backstory behind this.
Well, protests are not uncommon in Washington. We saw some demonstrations this weekend. Is this more of what we've seen before, or does this have a different feel to it?
I think this one has a different feel to it. And you know, I say something like, until we forget about it. I think there are a lot of people who aren't going to forget about this, and it has to do with the issues and the accusations regarding sexual assault. I mean, 1992, the election was called the Year of the Woman, because of the backlash against Thomas and some of the accusations about his harassment of women on the job. And so I think you're going to see something similar here. I mean, we've got 257 women running for one of the positions at the national level. And so although it hasn't yet been dubbed really the Year of the Woman, I think this is going to drive conversations as we go to the midterms, especially in those districts where there is a woman running or there are women running against each other. So I think that the protests are going to continue, but in a political forum rather than necessarily on the streets, because I think it's going to help to generate some discussions about women's role in politics, women's roles in elective offices, creating public policy. And so Kavanaugh unwittingly has created, I think, a conversation about the place and power of women in politics.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell described opposition to Kavanaugh's appointment as a great gift to Republicans just ahead of the midterms, saying it would energize the base. President Trump also signaled he plans to weaponize the nomination fight just ahead of the midterms. What's your take on this? Who gets helped? Who gets hurt here?
I'm not sure it's going to really give a bump to either side. Certainly the data show that there was an even split among the public about whether or not they supported Kavanaugh. And it's still within the margin of error, but independents were less likely to support Kavanaugh than to support his nomination. If there's a bump, and I'm not sure there will be a bump, it might accrue as evenly to both parties. You might generate the Republican base to come out and support their candidates, but you're just as likely to see Democrats do the same thing. And really, Supreme Court nominations, even when they get as animated as they have been in the last week or so, they tend not to be a real driver of public policy. Remember Tip O'Neill, the old Speaker of the House, used to say, all politics is local. If there's anything less local in American politics, it's the United States Supreme Court. So I'm not sure whether or not you're going to see this be the conversation starter for most people. I think it's going to be other issues, immigration, jobs, and those kinds of things that are typical in midterm elections.
Okay. We continue this conversation with St. Norbert College political scientist Charlie Jacobs just ahead. What do you think about our newest Supreme Court justice? Do you have reservations or are you all in? You wonder how this Supreme Court could affect your life here in Wisconsin. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Brett Kavanaugh is the newest justice on the nation's highest court after a bitter nomination battle in the U.S. Senate. What do you see as the political implications here? And will this vote cause you to cast a vote of your own in November? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, and he joins us to talk about the fallout from this nomination process. So what about the reaction of Democrats to the process and the confirmation? How do you think this will affect Democratic voters less than a month from the midterms? Republicans say that this fight is going to energize their base and actually get them to go out and vote in an election that some had said that a number of Republicans were going to stay home. But how will this affect Democratic voters going forward here?
For those who have been angry about what has transpired in the last 18 months or so, a little bit more since Trump was inaugurated, I mean, I think these people were all ready to vote. They were ready to vote a year ago or more, and to try to undo in any way what they think is happening to the nation. So I don't think it's going to really change those individuals much except get them more excited. It may drive them to do a little bit more work to get more people to the polls. I mean, typically what we see in midterm elections is a lower turnout for Democrats who tend to come out in greater numbers in the presidential election years. So the hope is that they can really drive a get-out-the-vote campaign to get people there. This may spur some Democrats, but I don't think this is one of those issues where fence sitters are really going to jump off and decide to get themselves to the polls. I think it might be a related issue, again, about women's rights, about the treatment of women under law, especially when it comes to matters of sexual assault. So you might see more women come out. But I think that they were generally motivated to come anyway. That's what the data tend to be showing us so far. But this is one of those things that's very fluid, and you don't exactly know what's going to transpire until after we see some of the data after the election. So this is one of those tricky things. I mean, usually we see in midterm elections issues related to pocketbook issues and unemployment and employment issues and whether or not people are feeling an effect of a growing or weakening economy. For Donald Trump, I think that's actually been a problem for him because even though the economy has been booming, I mean, we see that from statements from the Fed and from other economic analysis, he's not really getting the kind of credit that he thinks he deserves. And so if he's not getting credit on these kinds of issues, I'm not sure whether or not Republicans are going to feel as if this is a reason, the Supreme Court nomination, to get them to the polls. It seems like there's sort of a lackluster approach to what is transpiring in the United States. For Democrats, it's something totally different. I mean, they are just so angry that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 that I think that every little item that comes up in the news that seems to disparage Republicans and their governance is another reason for them to go. So just stack this on the pile, and it will likely at least keep people interested through November elections.
The so-called swing votes in the United States Senate indicated that they found the extra background check that was done on Brett Kavanaugh thorough. Does the fact that investigation took place add any credibility to now Justice Kavanaugh?
I think in the minds of some it will, because at least they didn't rush headlong into a vote. They did stop. And so I think that you can give the Senate and its leadership some credit for at least listening to members who are concerned about the rumors that they had heard about Judge Kavanaugh. And so I think it's going to give them some credibility. But the problem, of course, is they did not give deep access to the report to individual members. It hasn't been submitted to the public for their review. And there are those who are criticizing the process because it was too brief an investigation and one that didn't cover all of the major players and parties involved in the accusations that were made against Judge Kavanaugh. And so I think that on the one hand, people at least will say there was some measure of due process. Others will say it's a gigantic cover-up. And again, this is going to split right down partisan lines. I mean, if you look at some of the most recent Gallup poll data, the divide between Republicans and Democrats is sort of reflecting the current polarization that we're seeing. So I'm not sure whether or not the FBI investigation is going to do anything but entrench those points of view of partisans on each side. It may help to sway some of those swing voters who mm-hmm. are going to go to the polls, because they may perceive this differently. But again, even Gallup shows that is split rather evenly in the United States. This is really just sort of another clumsy partisan kind of event in recent United States history that I'm not sure we can read the tea leaves very clearly until well after the fact.
The New York Times reported that at one point the White House told Brett Kavanaugh that if he wanted to save his nomination, he needed to show how he felt. He responded to the testimony about sexual misconduct allegations by breaking down, yelling, occasionally snapping at senators on the Judiciary Committee. How are Americans interpreting this, and how well do you think that strategy worked for him?
I mean, I would say, at least in his own mind, he may have regretted it, considering his response a few days later in the Wall Street Journal, where he's trying to explain why he got that angry. And I think part of the strategy there was it worked very well for Justice Thomas in 1991. He came out and he was accusing the Senate, in particular the Senate Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, of what he called a high-tech lynching. And I think it really captured the imagination of the public. It gave them something to reflect on about how hard it is for an individual like that to take these kinds of accusations. And I think that Kavanaugh was hopeful to do the same. It's also a parallel strategy that Donald Trump himself uses. And so Kavanaugh might have taken those two cues as something to pursue while giving his second testimony. I'm not sure whether or not the public bought it. I think that what we see is that Thomas was a sympathetic figure in that situation. Brett Kavanaugh, who's perceived by many as among the elite, certainly white rather than African-American, might have been perceived as a little bit too abrasive in that kind of situation, especially the way he treated some of the members of the Judiciary Committee. And I think that's why you saw sort of his almost apology in the Wall Street Journal. Now, I suspect for some of Trump's supporters, they were very happy to see him stand up for himself, as though this individual were being discriminated against by certain factions within the United States. Again, I think this is going to split on partisan lines. What lens you're looking at this kind of testimony through. So Justice Kavanaugh, I think, was in an almost no-win situation. If you don't fight back, you look weak, and you might not be perceived as explaining the accusations against you. If you come out and you act like he did with his dukes up and ready to fight, it might be seen as too aggressive. So he was really, in many ways, in a no-win situation.
Let's take a call here. Randy is with us from Madison. Randy, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning. I made a response to what you just said. Somehow I think the drama queen aspect didn't serve him well either, but other people are saying it did. I was bothered by the fact that 98 people, when it came to voting day, knew he had perjured himself on issues like his drinking, his college days, his attitude towards women. And 50 of them said that's all right. What I wish I was seeing is that somebody was calling on Judge Kavanaugh to say, please withdraw for the good of the company. Of the country, not company.
Randy, thanks. I want to give our guest a chance to respond, and we're starting to run out of time here. Charlie Jacobs?
I mean, Randy raises a very good point, and some senators were really beating this drum that we need more time to investigate. And it was interesting about the way in which the Republicans were insisting on rushing the way that they were. Obviously, there's some nerves that they feel about what the polls are going to do to the majorities in the House and the Senate in November. And so they wanted to make sure that they got their man and they got him sworn into office. And so the whole perjury issue sort of was swept under the rug. Problem with perjury is trying to prove intent. And in that kind of situation, where he's trying to remember facts and figures from years back, I'm not saying that anyone is given permission to lie, but the argument can be made that he misremembered or would have liked his memory to be sort of reminded of exactly what he did and said in the past, rather than sort of gotcha questions. So there are all sorts of issues that are raised with this. Should they have slowed down and maybe reviewed these? Possibly. There's an argument to be made, but when Republicans are in control and driving the bus, they want to hit the accelerator as fast as they can. The House can always come back in impeachment proceedings if they gain the majority in the House and investigate it. It may reveal nothing. It may reveal something that could lead to articles of impeachment with potential removal by the Senate.
We're just about out of time, but if you could hit maybe the high points of what's coming on the Supreme Court's docket this term and what cases might benefit from having a strong conservative majority.
You know, the first part of this term is kind of a yawner, and some are arguing that the reason is that Roberts and the court decided to put some of the easier and less contentious cases early so that if they had to wait for a ninth member to join, they wouldn't have anything, one of the blockbusters. I think the biggest cases are going to be the gerrymandering cases, including the one from Wisconsin. Kennedy was always sympathetic to at least hearing arguments to roll back some of the laws and regulations that were giving advantage to one party or the other.
Okay.
Brett Kavanaugh does not seem as amenable to those arguments as Kennedy was.
We're going to have to leave it there. Charlie Jacobs, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, John.
Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. His areas of expertise include American politics and judicial process. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Emergency room physicians say they're seeing more violence on the job, according to a new report. We talk with a researcher about what's behind that, how physical abuse affects medical professionals both in and out of the ER, and what it would take to improve conditions. Do you work in an emergency room? Have you experienced violence on the job? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Gosh, if I could talk, I'd be a radio announcer. Or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Terry Kovalenko is chairman of emergency medicine at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine in Michigan. He's been studying workplace violence in the emergency room for more than a decade. Dr. Kovalenko, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
How common is it for emergency room workers to experience physical abuse on the job?
Our research really shows that it's prevalent among all the work groups within the emergency department, and nearly everyone experiences some form of violence, whether that be physical assault or a threat of violence. It's nearly all of them. Our study showed that little over 70% of the physicians only, now, mind you, physicians suffer the least amount of violence of the work groups within the emergency department, but 71% had suffered some sort of violence in the previous year.
And when we talk about violence, what kinds of things are we talking about?
It's really the spectrum of everything from a physical threat or an actual physical assault. The most common are being punched, kicked, or slapped, or spit on.
So how much more likely are ER workers to experience physical abuse on the job than the rest of the working population?
So within the healthcare setting, the emergency department is the area that has the most violence against workers. If you look at healthcare professionals, if you look at just nurses and physicians, and this isn't just emergency medicine, this is actually all, it's about three times more prevalent than this is now suffering a physical assault, about three times more prevalent than the general population. If you take all healthcare workers, it's actually closer to six times more prevalent. If you look back at some Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, if you look back to 2007, you'll see that 60% of all reported assaults occurred in a healthcare setting. And then in 2014, that number rose to 75%.
Why is this? Why is there so much more exposure to physical abuse and violence on the job than for other occupations?
Our research shows that there's really two big groups where these are the perpetrators, and that is those who have psychiatric illness or have substance abuse problems or sometimes suffer from both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of other environmental factors that take place. Emergency departments are frequently crowded. They're noisy. There's a lot of disruptions. There's a lot of stress. I mean, you have to remember that when people come to the emergency department, they're usually not there with something minor. It's something that's more serious, and it raises then tensions, and we believe that's part of the reason that this happens.
Hmm. In the report that came out from the American College of Emergency Physicians, almost 70% of doctors surveyed said they noticed an increase in violence in the last 5 years. I mean, it's all the emergency room, by its very definition, is always a pretty intense place. But what's been happening here that we've seen this increase over the last 5 years?
Well, that was a little bit surprising to us as well, to find that it was actually going up. Now, there may be two things going on. One may be that there actually is an increase in the actual numbers. And then secondly, I believe that because there's more and more work being done and more attention being brought to this problem, I think that it has increased our or decreased our tolerance for it. And I do believe that we're starting to report it much more often than we ever used to. Mm-hmm. It used to be that people just thought of it as part of the job, but I think more and more we're finding that that level of tolerance is going away.
You mentioned substance abuse as one of the issues here. Do we have any sense of how big a part of this problem that is, whether it's alcohol or some other drugs?
Yeah, our research shows that alcohol and other drugs are part of the problem. I can tell you that, for example, people don't realize this, but when somebody has an overdose on, say, an opioid, we give a medication to help reverse that. It was not uncommon for us to be helping them breathe, but then put them in restraints for their own protection and ours when we gave the medication to reverse them, because when they come out of this, they're very, very violent frequently. And you can imagine with alcohol, it's also common to have people that lose their inhibition and perpetrate violence against healthcare workers. It's not uncommon that once they finally sober up, they're often very surprised at their own behavior.
We're talking with Dr. Terry Kovalenko, Chairman of Emergency Medicine at Oakland University, William Beaumont School of Medicine in Michigan. He's been studying workplace violence in the emergency room for more than a decade. You mentioned earlier that the numbers we've been talking about that's about doctors, but the suggestion here is that the people who see patients first in the ER, the nurses, the workers at the front end of this operation are seeing even more. Do we have any idea what those numbers are like?
Yeah, so nurses and techs definitely have experienced a greater prevalence of violence perpetrated against them. And our research shows that really there's a direct correlation between the amount of time you spend with a patient and then having the increased incidence of violence. So with our nurses, it's almost 100% with what we found. And if you look at some of the studies, ours have shown that up to 60% have been physically assaulted at least once in the previous year, and many of them more than that. And as I said before, physicians actually, although they're not immune to it, their numbers are lower than that of the nurses and the techs.
So, I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. Listeners, do you work in an emergency room? Have you experienced violence on the job? And how did it impact your life, both in and out of the ER? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Kovalenko, you've said that the increase in violence that you're seeing in the research could be in part due to employees reporting abuse more often. Why would they have kept it to themselves before?
So there's a multitude of reasons that we found that there was underreporting. First of all, we know that there's underreporting even today, but it's better today than it was even a decade ago. Part of it was that it was a potentially an onerous process. And you can imagine if you're a nurse who just finished a 12-hour shift, and you were shoved during the shift, but you weren't physically hurt by it, you might not take the time to fill out some sort of a form to report it. And the other things we found were that there was a fear that if you reported it more often, people might think of you as the problem. You can imagine that if two different people have different thresholds for what they report, one reports everything and the other one reports nothing. If you're an administrator looking at these reports and you see one name keeps coming up, you may actually think that that may be that person may be the problem, when in fact they're not the problem. They're just reporting more often.
Do we have a sense of how underreported this abuse has been in an ER setting?
Yeah. So our numbers show that it's only the reporting rate is probably less than 50%, and actually, when you look at that, that's just reporting to the hospital. When you look at actually reporting to police, every study we've had has been less than 5% of the time do they report anything to the police.
Hmm. Well, I suppose going back to your earlier comments about why they don't report, that reporting to the police would just increase the amount of paperwork and the time they would have to spend after the fact to deal with this.
And there's also a fear of retribution, either from the perpetrator or from work itself, if they continue to go forward. The other groups of people that we know are underreported are groups where we, as healthcare professionals, realize that they're not under their own control. So, for example, small children or older adults with dementia. Frequently, if you're starting an IV or something like that, it's painful to that person,
mm-hmm.
and they react, and they can cause react in a violent manner, and we know that those instances are almost never reported.
I would like to start at least having a conversation here about the actual effect of this physical abuse on ER workers. We're coming up to a pause in the program here, so we'll probably continue this afterwards, but let's talk about the impact of this this abuse on ER workers. I'm assuming there's a physical toll. What is the physical toll here?
So depending on what ends up happening to the person, I mean, I've seen everything from a person having facial bones broken and a tooth knocked out to being slashed and cut with somebody that broke a computer screen and then used that as a weapon against some of our nurses. So the extent of physical violence really is runs the gamut. But beyond the physical damage, there is the psychological component. And you don't even have to necessarily be the victim of the violent act. You just need to be a witness of it. And I can tell you that with some of the debriefings that we've done with some of our employees when there have been instances like this, it is not uncommon that all of the witnesses suffer significantly from it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that there's issues that are psychological, and there have been plenty of studies that have shown there's been instances of PTSD. And then, not infrequently, especially among the nursing staff, they look to find a different position somewhere else.
Okay. And I want to continue that part of the conversation as the program moves forward here. Dr. Terry Kovalenko is our guest. He's the chairman of the emergency medicine at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine in Michigan. This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Emergency room physicians say they're seeing more violence on the job, according to a new report. If you work in the healthcare industry, if you work in an ER, does your workplace have strategies in place to protect you from potentially violent patients? And if so, how are they working? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Terry Kovalenko is chairman of emergency medicine at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine in Michigan. He's been studying workplace violence in the emergency room for more than a decade. Dr. Kovalenko, we were talking about what the violence in the ER costs workers physically and mentally, and that some actually leave emergency room work. Would this represent an added cost for hospitals? Does this violence in the ER end up costing money in terms of what it costs to provide health care?
Yeah, undoubtedly it does, because when we have a relatively high turnover rate of nursing, and emergency nurses have the highest turnover rate of all the nurses. And as I said before, part of that is this exposure to violence. And obviously then it costs money to recruit and train new nurses.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kovalenko, you've been assaulted by patients before. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so three come to mind. One was a tragic scene of an unfortunate situation of a grieving mother of a small child that we were unable to resuscitate, and she attacked me while we were giving the news. I had another instance of an intoxicated patient who grabbed me by my throat, and I was able to get away. But the one instance that really affected me more than any other was not even the physical assault, it was the threat of physical violence. And it was a patient that told me he knew my shift ended at 11 o'clock at night, he knew where the doctor's lot was, and that he would be waiting there for me. That was probably the scariest one of all of them.
When you were in medical school, what was your sense of how dangerous the job could be?
I had no sense. I had no sense of the danger, not at all. And as time has gone on, we all recognize it. One of the other reasons we think that some of the numbers are going up is that we know that we have fewer and fewer psychiatric inpatient units, and so more and more of these patients end up in the emergency department. And given, as I said before, the level of agitation, possibly intoxication, and then the stresses in the emergency department, obviously that adds to this problem as well.
Is there any, what about what's going on in our medical schools? Should this kind of training have been offered to you as you were going through the program? What about in nursing? Is physical abuse something that they need to prepare people for? And if so, are they doing it?
Yeah, now it's mandatory. And the Emergency Nurses Association has taken really a lead on some of these things, and they have some toolkits with regard to instructing nurses on how to deal with the physically violent patient. There's really three different ways, four different ways that we're dealing with it. One is environmental, another is policies and procedures, and then the third is education and training. And as I said, certainly nursing goes through all of this. They do it at least once, and usually they have refreshers yearly for training of this. But you can imagine that this is it's a difficult issue, is that when I used to instruct people for self-defense, and instructing a person for self-defense from the general public is very different than in the emergency department. As you can imagine, it's very important that we teach folks how to defend themselves in the emergency department, but not cause harm to the patient, which is very different than what you would do on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a caller. Melissa joins us from Oshkosh. Melissa, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
I work in mental health at a state-run mental health facility, and I have seen the issue of retention of our frontline staff being our nursing staff who have been attacked over and over and over again. And they're being replaced with less experienced staff, leaving our senior staff more at risk, and it's concerning.
Melissa, thank you for sharing your story with us. Dr. Kovalenko?
Yeah, this is not at all surprising. And as I mentioned before, is that with the high turnover rate, then you have to recruit new people, and then there's a whole brand new training that has to go into place there. So replacing an experienced nurse with a new nurse is not the same until they get up to speed, which can sometimes take, you know, weeks to months.
Well, and it sounds, from Melissa's perspective, that this is a problem that isn't just confined to the ER. It's we're seeing it elsewhere in healthcare as well. And part of it is a public policy issue.
Yeah, actually, within the hospital setting, emergency department is the area that has the most violence. But number two are psychiatric units.
Were emergency room physicians say they're seeing more violence on the job, according to a new report. Does your workplace have a strategy in place to protect you from potentially violent patients? 800-642-1234. Dr. Terry Kovalenko is with us this hour. He's been studying workplace violence in the emergency room for more than a decade. So, I guess the big question here is, what is being done to curb the physical abuse that emergency room physicians, nurses, and technicians face on a daily basis?
So, as I mentioned before, there's really three key strategies, and one might even add a fourth being legislation. But the three categories are really environmental, policies and procedures, and then education and training. And when I talk about environmental, what I'm referring to is, for example, installing panic buttons, having secure entrances, increased lighting, metal detectors, increasing the security presence, which actually our study did show that since our first time studying this in Michigan to now, there has definitely been an increase in security in emergency departments. But having cameras, locked doors, having keys, keyed entry with key cards. And then from policies and procedures is really the most important one is to report it. And I've been really on my soapbox for years now trying to tell healthcare workers that they have to report this stuff, because if they don't report it, administrators don't think then that there is a problem. And it's not their fault if we're not reporting. So we really need to do a lot more reporting of this and then try to work with our security officers. For example, the hospital I work in, we have a great relationship with our security personnel, and we've added some strategies. And for example, we put most of our mental health patients, we put them together in an area, and we have a dedicated security officer to that area, and that's really decreased the number of instances we've had. And then the education, as I said before, but not only teaching people how to defend themselves, but I think it's really important to teach them how to recognize a potentially violent patient, how to potentially de-escalate that person, because ideally we don't want the violence to occur at all. And then the fourth strategy, and I think 29 states now do have laws in place that make it a felony to assault a healthcare worker. Now, the only downside to those is that somebody had to be a victim in order for that to work.
Yeah, and some people might not be as likely to report it if it is a felony. So, you know, you've got that whole conundrum again. So what's the consequence of doing nothing here?
Well, I think the greatest fear, if you do nothing, is that the violence continues or gets worse. And just accepting it is not a solution. And just saying that this is part of the work environment is not acceptable.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Doctor, I really appreciate your time with us, Dr. Kovalenko. Thank you. Dr. Terry Kovalenko has been studying workplace violence in the ER for more than a decade. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.